And as we're gathering here, let's turn together in the Word of God to 1 Corinthians 9. And I want to begin reading at verse 19 through verse 23. And here Paul is writing in the context of his ministry as an apostle and his rights and so forth as an apostle, but yet speaks of his own condescension for the sake of others to win them to the gospel, by the gospel. So in verse 19 of 1 Corinthians 9, he says this, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." So I want to speak with you a little bit about what's called contextualization. It's one of the big buzzwords in missions studies. And just want to ask your forgiveness from the get-go. This is a subject that I, after so many years, still have never delved into writing on it. It's a difficult subject, so a lot of my thoughts are still sort of floating around in my head in embryonic form. So my notes a little bit, hopefully it didn't sound too disorganized, but I want to just throw out some ideas and for discussion. Hopefully discussion time will be a little more interactive. So Paul here speaks, and this is sort of the contextualization passage. Contextualization, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Anybody seen that movie? The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. It's a classic, right? So contextualization. What is contextualization? Why is it important to think about? How should we think about it rightly? What are some good parts of it? Some parts not so good? And what are the things that we should avoid? So contextualization. I want to give you a definition, first of all, of what culture is. And this is a good summary definition. This is in the book that I helped co-edit and write some chapters, Planting, Watering, and Growing. And my friend Shane Lems says this in his chapter, speaking about culture. So one thing about culture, how we relate to culture, what part does culture play in our evangelism, our church life. He defines culture as a broad way as the habits, lifestyles, beliefs, and traditions of a local people group. So habits, lifestyles, beliefs, and traditions of a local people group. And I think it's important because we talk a lot about the culture, don't we? The culture is going bad. The culture is declining. Our culture, you know, is this or that. But it's important to recognize that while we do have a culture here in North America, the West, and in particular the United States, or in, say, Mexico, there's a certain culture, but yet every state has its own culture. Any Texans here? No Texans. Cypri, not from Texas. No Texans here, right? So Texas has its own particular ethos and culture. California has a culture, but California, for those of us who are natives, there's no Cal, and then there's SoCal, right? Any no-calers here? It's not really even California, is it? I can't make fun of the no-calers, and I'm not even here. That's why we call it no-Cal. It's not even California. It's totally different. Once you get north of, it used to be north of Los Angeles, but now L.A. sort of sprawled, right, all the way up to, say, Santa Barbara, even farther than that. But it used to be where you started to get to the Grapevine, and once you get to the Grapevine, then that's sort of Central Valley, and that's a whole other thing, right? You have SoCal, and you have Farmville, and then you have Then you have the northern part of the state and all the fun that that part of the state has brought to our state and to our culture. So it's important to think about culture in terms of localized culture. There are broad ideas and broad things going on, but every region, every county, every city, every neighborhood really has its own particular culture. If you drive around, say, where I'm at in Oceanside, it's no different than a lot of other places. You have neighborhoods that are gated communities, and you have gated neighborhoods that are not gated communities. The gated communities have a particular culture, right? Having a gate around your neighborhood, it just itself connotes a certain culture, doesn't it? I live in a gated community, so I can poke fun at it. So we self-impose our communistic homeowners associations on ourselves, and we complain about them. They charge us too much money. They complain about, you know, my lawn not being watered enough or fertilized enough. So, but a gated community has a certain culture to it, and the neighborhoods next door that don't, well, they have their own particular culture. So cultures are local things, and I think it's helpful for us to think about, in terms of church planting and missions, not to just think about, you know, everyone's a sinner, we're going to send some random guy who's just available to some particular place. We need to think about the culture in which that person's going, the context in which he's going, and who he is and how he may or may not fit into that particular culture and context. So culture, just broad habits, lifestyles, languages, patterns of thought, belief, traditions, and so forth. That's a culture. What about contextualization, or the context, the process of entering a particular culture and context? What is that? Another of my colleagues, Phil Grotenheis, he's now in Phoenix, he defines, in that same book, Planting, Watering, Growing, he defines contextualization as the relationship between gospel and culture. That's a real easy, memorable way of thinking about it. How does the gospel relate to culture? So that particular local flavor of a culture, as well as the broader perspective and broader ideas of culture itself. How does the gospel relate? So that's a good question for us. That's an important question for us to think about in whatever local place we find ourselves. How does the gospel relate to our city, our neighborhood, our region, state, nation, and hemisphere, and so forth, going out in concentric circles? So the good, the bad, the ugly. And I want to use as an example of some things that are helpful and some things that are not as helpful in this book by Darren Patrick called Church Planter. He's an Acts 29 pastor, church planter. He has a new book that just came out called Replant. It's he and another pastor on how they took a dying church and they revitalized it as sort of a case study. I just put it on my wish list last night on Amazon. I haven't read it yet. But his book on Church Planter, they're not... There's no other book that I know of on the church planter himself. There are books on church planting and missions, evangelism, but not on, you know, the man in particular, especially of church planting. So a lot of it is very simple and very basic, things that you can read very quickly. Some of it's helpful to think about and challenging to think about. But his chapter on contextualization is a good place to kind of jump into as an example of how broader evangelical Christians and, you know, closer to us in somewhat reformed circles think about context, culture, and the relationship of the gospel to all of that. Here's how he defines contextualization. He says there's an older way of defining it, which was the process of taking the gospel to different cultures. That's kind of what Grotenheis mentioned. Then he says this, it's taking, and think about this, and what you think about this line. It is, contextualization, it is simply the taking of the unchanging gospel into an oft-changing culture. So, to me, so far so good with that. So, taking the unchanging gospel into an oft-changing culture. I don't think any of us would disagree with that. But then here's where it gets a little tricky. By restating the meaning of the gospel in a way that is comprehensible to those who are hearing the gospel. So how does the gospel relate? That's the simple definition of contextualization. Darren Patrick, though, says, we do that by restating the meaning of the gospel in a way that is comprehensible to those who are hearing the gospel. We want people to comprehend the gospel. There's no doubt about that. Paul here is seeking to do that. He's describing his own ministry, seeking to do that to the Jews, to the Greeks, to those under the law, to those outside the law, to the weak, the strong, and so forth, trying to do that so that he would win them, right? That he might, by all means, save some. So it is important for us to be comprehensible and comprehensible to those that we are speaking to with the gospel. But yet, we're beginning to get into some trouble, I think. The whole idea of contextualization, even in the broader Reformed world, is by speaking about it in terms of restating the meaning of the gospel. So he speaks about, and we speak about, an unchanging gospel in an oft-changing culture or world. But then we speak about that unchanging gospel, but yet we speak about it in changeable ways. Do we change the gospel meaning for those in China? Do we change the gospel's meaning for those in Latin and South America? Do we change the gospel and restate the gospel for those under communism, for those in this culture and that culture? That's where, in my mind, as I'm thinking about this whole issue, the whole idea of contextualization becomes problematic. And it begins to kind of go off of the rails. He says again this in his book, on the bottom of page 194. Again, he says very helpful and very good things for us. But then he takes this passage from 1 Corinthians 9, and here's what he says. He says, on the other hand, we contextualize the gospel as Paul did. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. We contextualize the gospel. It's my contention in my thesis, and I've not really seen this written in many places by Reformed people. It's my contention that the man is contextualized, not the message. That's what Paul's saying here. It's not the message that we restate and refashion, contextualize for the hearers, but it's the man himself who is contextualized. As an example, things that the man himself must enter into and must adapt to, things that are sort of circumstantial, if you will, not essential to the ministry. How a man dresses, certain customs in a particular place, food, for example. Paul deals with food a lot, doesn't he? In Corinthians as well as Romans, Jews and Gentiles, and food offered to idols and so forth. How do we relate to food in that context? And with Paul, as the law, the ceremonial laws had come to their fulfillment in Christ, and now rise and eat, kill and eat, and so forth. How do we relate to outward, external, circumstantial things? We contextualize ourselves into those things. I think about, there's a book that got for my kids. It's a children's biography of Hudson Taylor. And if you look at the pictures of Hudson Taylor, what did he look like when he was in China? He looked like he was from China, doesn't he? Or didn't he? He didn't look like an Englishman who showed up and imposed his dress, culture, and so forth on the Chinese. He dressed. He had the David Reese beard. But Hudson Taylor was what he looked like. He was from the culture. He fit in, as we might say. So that he can win people to Christ. The message doesn't change, but it's the man who changes. And Tim Keller has a couple of helpful things that he says in terms of contextualization. Again, he speaks about it in a way that I'm not comfortable with, by saying that we adapt certain things. But what he does say that is helpful is this. That it's changing those aspects of ministry that are culturally conditioned. So changing those aspects of ministry that are culturally conditioned. My son and I just downloaded the app for the Book of Psalms for worship. Is it necessary to sing out of a hymnal? A substantive book. I think it's helpful. I think it communicates something. But ultimately, must we go into a culture and bring with us large quantities of hardcover hymnals? Can they not sing in other ways? So there are things about the ministry that are culturally conditioned. Dress and other things. Secondly, he says, we also need to be maintaining those aspects of ministry that are unchanging and biblically required. So things like things that are circumstantial, things that are substantial, elemental to the ministry. Do we need to have big raised wooden pulpits in order to preach the gospel? I think it's awesome. But do we ultimately need to have a wood pulpit? I mean, you can make the case, I guess, Nehemiah built this platform. But it was a platform. He wasn't behind a pulpit. It was upon a wooden platform. I think it communicates something of reverence and things that transcend, that are firm and fixed. But ultimately, that is something that we can see, at least I see, as a circumstance, a thing that's not of the essence of what's going on in worship. We are to preach the word, and how that happens isn't as fixed. I wear a robe when I preach, just a plain Genevan robe, but I would never argue that that's essential to the preaching of the gospel. I forgot my robe once, and I barely even wear this little suit jacket. I just throw it on when I don't have my robe on. So I had a shirt and a tie. I felt so naked. I felt so naked. You know, I'm just having this big robe on me to cover me up and hide me. But the word still was preached, wasn't it? It doesn't matter what the man is wearing. So ultimately, it doesn't matter if you're wearing a Hawaiian shirt or a robe. The word is proclaimed. That issue of dress is a cultural thing, I think, that communicates something that needs to be dealt with in a wise way. But ultimately, that's something that we can adapt into a culture, and even be different from a culture if it needs to be, to ourselves be contextualized. So maybe the terms that we use are just knowing the terms of a certain local culture, the way of speech, just the ways of thinking, the ways of dressing. These are things that are helpful for us to think about. How can I enter into this particular culture, this particular place? It's also important to realize a lot of the discussion about contextualization. If you read Darren Patrick's chapter, he talks a lot here about the church that he began. One of the ways that he gives us an illustration of contextualization is by reaching out to the local artist community. And I take some guilty pleasure in every once in a while reading Carl Truman's blog, where he takes a task only thinking about contextualization and only thinking about, ministry in terms of sort of, highbrow artists, right? Can we not contextualize ourselves in a homeless shelter? Do we need to initially go and reach out to artists? Is that the only way or the best way to do it? Now, maybe in his context, that was important. Maybe it is in some places, but a lot of times, contextualization is sort of buzzword for what I think is sort of upper middle class white America, as a way to make it seem like we're doing mission, as opposed to in Oceanside we have a very diverse community, very eclectic, and very very integrated city, and trying to realize if you try to enter into one particular segment of that local community, you are just by default going to alienate someone else, right? So in our church, we have a very good mix. We have everything between white and black in our congregation, and people from all tribes and languages and nations. And so you need to try to and attempt to, as Paul says, to be all things to all people. And so thinking about that context that you're in, you know, what am I doing? How do I dress? How do I speak? What are the things that we do that may be a big faux pas to a certain genre of people or a subset of people? In the circles in which, you know, I've become Reformed and in which I minister, you know, sort of like a badge of honor that you smoke cigars in public and that you flaunt your microbrew, you know, your favorite beer. You know, we go to the Stone Brewery, and you know, you very publicly display in two hands, you know, your case in this hand, your IPA in that hand, and your double IPA in the other hand, you know, and it's sort of like a badge of honor, at least in the little circle in which I'm at. I found that while most people, at least that I have come across, don't have a problem with drinking alcohol. They have a problem with flaunting it, right? Even in our home, we try not to serve alcohol when we have lunch, that kind of thing. We basically, you know, I have beer in my refrigerator, and people know that they can go into my fridge and get whatever they want when they come over for food. But just very recently, started to think, you know, it's not a big deal to me, but it may be a big deal, and it can be a big deal. But basically, you know, for the sake of others, not serve alcohol at, you know, sort of church function. I'm no teetotaler, but I think it's a helpful way just to communicate to people. Again, in my own context, we're not antinomian. We're not just like flaunting our liberty. You know, we've all come, most of the congregation that are new Christians, you know, they don't really know these things, but most other believers in our congregation come out of some kind of a fundamentalistic, you know, Pentecostal, Calvary Chapel or something else where alcohol is like one of the mortal sins. And, you know, we kind of overreact to that. So I've just found it to be helpful that, you know, not wanting to communicate, not even the alcohol issue itself, but the issue of, you know, how do I view piety and liberty and wanting to show people that I am free in Christ, but I'm also free not to drink. I'm also free not to offer beers, right? Freedom goes both ways. So I think we're free to enjoy the good gifts that God has given us, but we're also free not to. That's what freedom is, right? And so Christ has liberated us from ourselves and our own wants and desires. So contextualization then. This is an issue that I've just, as I've been reading over the last few years, starting to see that a lot of our forefathers dealt with this issue. They didn't deal with it with the term context or culture or contextualization. But there's a lot of discussion in church fathers and medieval theologians of something of contextualization. Just give you a couple examples of ways in which this has been dealt with. And not agreeing necessarily with, you know, the outcomes, but at least the issue is an issue that's been around since the church has existed. I mean, since Paul's day, right? For example, when the gospel began to spread into the region of what's now Germany, but Germania, in the early period of the Roman Empire, first few centuries of the Christian church, as the gospel was spread, what happened was the bishops and those that were preaching realized that in Germanian culture, whatever the king or the tribal leader believed, all his people believed. Now, that was something that was true across the Mediterranean in that time. But they saw that in particular in these local tribal allegiances that people believed what their king or their tribal leader believed. And so what later on became a slogan at the time of the Reformation, whose region, whose religion, is a translation of a Latin phrase, which meant whoever the king was in power, that's the religion, whether it was Catholic, Lutheran, or Calvinist. that came out of early, early church, early medieval period, in which the gospel was being spread. And so the church adapted itself then, and so it began to preach not merely sort of one-to-one, but very early on, the strategy was to reach kings, to reach leaders. So you have, say, in Armenia, the first Christian kingdom, where the king converts and declares his subjects Christians. And we see that, of course, with Constantine and with others. But that begins to spread. And so they see that it was a key strategy to focus on leaders in that place because people would follow their leaders. Now, that may not be the same anymore because, obviously, you know, we're all more enlightened than that, aren't we? We have our democracy and we get to, you know, be captain of our own soul and captain of our own destiny. But that's a way in which they contextualize themselves for the sake of spreading the gospel. Gregory the Great, one of the great early bishops of Rome, he died in 604. He has a letter to a man speaking about accommodating to the English people. So as the gospel went to what we now is the English people, Anglia, in those days, he spoke about accommodating to those people, their customs, their dress, their festivals even, and so forth. You know, we don't necessarily agree with accommodating all those things, but they're dealing with this issue of bringing Christianity, which was part and parcel with Roman culture, to a people that were not Roman and had no Roman culture. They had their own culture. And so how do we accommodate ourselves? And so Gregory writes various letters, treatises dealing with that. In his Contra Summa Gentiles, Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, speaks in this way. This is his great apologetical text bring the gospel to the Gentiles, to the nations. Aquinas says that to the Jews, when we do apologetics, when we preach the gospel to the Jews, we appeal to the Old Testament. So we take into account the people that we preach to. So the Jews realize and recognize the Old Testament as the Word of God. And so when you preach to a Jew, you appeal to their books, the Old Testament. They recognize it as authoritative. Therefore, if you appeal to them, they'll listen to you. He says to heretics, he's speaking of Christian heretics, we appeal to the New Testament. They should know better. They have the letters of Paul. They have the Gospels. And so we appeal to the New Testament and make our case on the basis of those letters, those writings. To pagans and Muslims, he says, we appeal to natural reason because they don't accept the authority of the Word. Well, that's not necessarily true. In fact, Islam does recognize the Old Testament. They do recognize in theory the New Testament, but they would say ours is totally corrupted, so it's beyond repair. But he said, at least taking into account, you know, Islam as well as other pagan religions, that we appeal to a natural reason, not making a case for that necessarily, but he says that we do that because that's what they accept as authoritative. At minimum, what he's saying there is that we find some entryway into speaking to people on the basis of their culture, their forms of thought, their language, and so forth. That's not changing the gospel from where I stand. That's just simply finding a way to get in the door, as it were, to speak to people. And so we need to be aware of the people that we're speaking to, the context, the culture. In the 17th century, Gijsbertus Fuchsius, a great Dutch Reformed theologian, he was a delegate to the Synod of Dort and great. He lived for 80 some odd years. One of the great great fathers of the Dutch Reformation, and the Second Reformation, as it's called. He has a large treatise, De Plantatione Ecclesiae, Planting of Churches, where he says that we need to take into account those that we send missionaries to. And he gives, again, he's 17th century, so he's writing his own context, but he says that he divides peoples into lettered people and unlettered people. He would be a good whipping boy for
for anti-colonialism, wouldn't he? Speaking of lettered and unlettered peoples, showing his biases. But he says, if you're sending a missionary in the gospel to an unlettered people, meaning a people that they don't know much about philosophy, history, medicine, sort of the arts of education, we need to take that into account. And we need to send them. He doesn't say send them a total dummy, but he says send them one who is not, utterly in the realm of the noumenal, to use sort of Kantian terms, whose minds are not just sort of taken up with Gerhardus Voss all day long and, you know, the great grand sweep of redemptive history. Send them someone that can relate, is what he's saying. And so if you send someone, though, to a lettered culture, people that have history and philosophy and know big ideas and are very astute and learned peoples, he says that you need to send them the best of the best. You need to send them a man that can interact with them on the basis of astronomy and history and philosophy and be able to stand toe-to-toe with those people in order to bring to them the gospel. We see that, of course, in Paul, not just here in 1 Corinthians 9, but you see that in Paul as he goes and he preaches to Jews in synagogues. Of course, he preaches from the Old Testament. When he preaches to Gentiles or to Greeks, he appeals to them on the basis of their own poets, their own philosophers, their own writings, as a way to bring to them this message of the resurrection of Christ and the appeal and the command to them to repent and to believe. So this is a big issue in our history. It's something that we, as on the more confessional, crusty, old Calvinistic side of Reformed churches, we don't think about these things much as we should. And so it seems like the day has been won by those that would say that we need to contextualize the gospel and change the gospel's message somehow for people. I think what we need to do is to push back on that and say, no, it's the man who is changed, who must change, while the message stays the same. Phil Grotenheis, in his chapter in that book, Planting, Watering, Growing, he makes a helpful little descriptive way of thinking of this. He talks about a fossil theology and a chameleon theology. Fossil theology and a chameleon theology. A fossil theology, it's what he describes as faithfulness without relevance. That's getting up there, no matter the context, no matter the crowd, dumping tons of doctrine, history, background to whatever book you're preaching on. Like I mentioned in the last lecture, I've been preaching through the books of Samuel. I mean, I throw out like a little nuggets. Who are these Ammonites? What were the Philistines like? But that's, it's not the time and place to get up there and to show, you know, my acquaintance with, or my lack of acquaintance with, ancient Near Eastern cultures and histories. The canonical writers weren't so taken up with knowing all that background information. They were interested in bringing us the message of the Lord and His faithfulness. So we can have a fossil theology. We can overreact to writings that say that we need to contextualize the message. And so it's very easy for us to just run the other way and say, no, as long as we faithfully preach the message and we just dig into the Word and we teach the confessions, as long as we do that, we're good to go. We've done our job. We can wring our hands, wash our hands, and go away. But it's important to think about, not just in preaching, but also in our worship. I can only imagine, it's hard enough to plant a Reformed church in general. I can only imagine doing it without having any music at all besides the human voice. That's just me as an outsider. That's going to be hard. I can only imagine what people are thinking when they come into our church and we have just a piano and we have these hymnals and we're singing these and thous and these hymns, you know, the words are great, but it's odd. I can only imagine, doubly so, if not more, doing that without, you know, all the trappings of what most people who have any church background are used to, and all the music. So it's easy to be sort of a fossil theologian and to say, well, you know, we sing psalms a cappella, and that's our way or the highway. It's very easy to do that, I would assume. How can you be faithful, but also relevant to explain to people, to help them? And I would think, just as a practical aside, this is what we do in our church. We, from time to time, try to remind our members in a congregational meeting or some other setting. Maybe I write like a little pamphlet to the church, or maybe an email, or even just say it from the pulpit at times. We have lots of visitors for our members to realize that these people, for the most part, were assuming that they don't even know what a hymnal is. The first time I walked into the Reformed Church, I was like, do I turn it this way? Do I turn it that way? Is it this way? You know, I had no idea. I never held a hymnal in my entire life when I walked into a Reformed Church. So we tell our people, one way for us to be faithful but also to be relevant is to sit next to a visitor and actually pull the hymnal out of the pew. Takes all that effort, you know, pull out of the pew for them, and actually open it up and show them where to sing. Here's the number that we're singing. And actually help them. And we have a large sanctuary that we lease. We only put hymnals in the first, like, 12, 13 rows. Oftentimes, those hymnals kind of get moved around and people sit far away. When we start to sing, it looks a little chaotic to the average good, you know, upstanding Dutch Reformed person who visits our church from a good, large Dutch Reformed church in Canada or something like that. It looks chaotic because we have members crossing through the aisles, passing out hymnals. But I think that's one way in which, as we're trying to communicate the substance and the dialogue aspect of our worship, one way to be relevant, to help people, and even sit next to them and stand next to them and hold the hymnal for them and even line it out for them if you have to. So it's easy to overreact and just do the fossil theology, as Grotenheim says. It's also easy to do what he describes as a chameleon theology, which is relevance without faithfulness. How many of us here did not grow up Reformed? Hey, it's like about half. Cool. We've all seen that, right? Relevance without faithfulness. What does relevance without faithfulness look like? Concert, right? It's a concert. Whatever you can, use your wildest imagination, right? That's relevance, because that's what it takes to reach people. We have a large mega church just down the road from us. We have several mega churches, but one of them in particular is known for the fact that they have like a half a dozen different venues, as they call them, on Sunday morning, where if you're into like country western music, they have a country western theme. We have a big Hawaiian and Samoan population in Oceanside, and so they have I can't remember the title of it. It's something it's like an islander sort of theme. I can't remember. They have a funny name for it. It's sort of like, you know, you come in your flip flops, you know, your Hawaiian T-shirt, just that come as you are kind of attitude. They have like a coffee shop sort of feel to one of them, where it's like the elevated high coffee shop stools, and the bulletin looks like a menu. They have one that's like the traditional, and for them traditional is, you know, a piano with a big sort of choir, and they have like an alternative, it's always for the youth, right? They have sort of the alternative service. That is relevant for a lot of people. And they see that as being faithful to what Paul would say here. You know, they're trying to be all things to all people. But yet, you know, those of us who grew up in those kind of churches or have had any contact with those kind of churches, we know that, being charitable, you know, there's a simple gospel, but that's about it. It's not much of a gospel at all. So we don't want to be tempted, of course, and I don't think here we are tempted. But it can be easy in our denominations for us to wants to be bigger, and for us to want to be more relevant, and for us to want to be more liked and to be, you know, cooler and hipper. So, you know, it's always a danger for us to be on the guard of that we overreact to the traditionalism, and we turn into these chameleons that will try and do almost anything to win people to Christ. Grotenhuis has a good answer to that sort of dichotomy, fossil and chameleon, which is a good summary of where I think we would be here. He says this, is on page 263 in Planting, Watering, Growing. He says the answer is this: confessional orthodoxy clothed in words and deeds that are accessible to the culture. So confessional orthodoxy clothed in words and deeds that are accessible to the culture. It's important that we recognize, obviously, the words need to be accessible, but our deeds need to help people access the stuff that we do. For, like I mentioned, the example of, you know, helping people out in the pews with hymnals. We have every single Sunday, we have lunch at one of our members' homes in which all those who are new are invited, and that's one of the ways that our church grows, is by people being blown away by our hospitality. They've never gone to a church where the first time they showed up, they were actually like talked to. They're actually, besides, you know, great to see you with a big sort of cheesy smile, and, you know, shuffle their kids off to children's church, shuffle their high school kids to their high school church, and then, you know, because if you read the church growth literature, they tell you don't, you know, make the personal like contact. Leave people alone. Let them kind of float and let them kind of find their way. We take the total opposite. And honestly, it repels people because we want people to feel loved and welcomed, and that we actually are desirous of them and want to know them. And so I tell our members, you know, the greeters and those who pass out bulletins and those who are a little more outward, don't go up to people. So what does it look like to have deeds that can clothe this confessional orthodoxy? Don't walk up to a visitor and the first thing that you ask them is, are they pedo or are they credo, right? Don't ask them if they're infra or supra, okay? That's just, don't even go there, right? Don't start there. Don't ask them, you know, who's their favorite theologian of the 20th century, Van Til or Gordon Clark, right? Or, you know, you find your sort of pet, you know, opposites and whatever. Ask them who, you know, introduce yourself. Ask their name. Repeat their name, you know. Be nice to them. Show them where the snacks are at. If they have snacks, show them where the bathroom's at. If they need to go to the bathroom, show them where, you know, this is at. Help them. Just be a general, normal human being, right? Just, you know, be who we are as image bearers of God. So, you know, hospitality, just general love and concern and friendliness in a church. We have other things that we do. You know, we're close to the beach, so we have, you know, beach, you know, picnics, that kind of thing. And we have small groups. We invite neighbors to have dinner with us and that sort of thing. But whatever it is in your particular culture that is a helpful way to in deeds clothe the gospel in this confessional orthodoxy as we believe it, you know, find those ways in which to do that, to be accessible to people and to help them. So, how is context bad news? How is context good news? Coming closer to the end, if you're keeping score. How is context bad news for planting a church? Well, it's bad news because it's bad news. The world is the world, right? The natural man doesn't comprehend the things of the Spirit of God. So whichever culture we find ourselves in, the culture is bad news. People are rebellious towards God. People are idol worshippers. They have idol factories in their little brains and so forth. Culture, on the one hand, is bad news. The Christian church is its own culture, and it seeks to, through its culture, impact the wider culture for the glory of God. But yet, there's always going to be persecution. There's always going to be pushback. And, of course, we see that in our own time and place now. So context is bad news. And that's to say, don't view it as an idol. Don't view, you know, if I come up with this great analysis of Oceanside, or this great analysis of whatever city you find yourself in, you know, if I have all this data and all the stats and all the demographics, if I get all that right, and if I tailor it all for that particular context, somehow or another, you know, we're going to build this thing and they're just going to come. Context is bad news. We're dealing with sinners, dealing with a fallen world. So don't view it as an idol. Don't be a slave to culture. Don't be a servant of the context. Let it and allow it to serve you and your needs. But how is it good news? How is it good news that the culture is all that? Well, I can think of at least one way it's good news. It's good news because we have a context in which to speak something totally different. Not only as Christians, but especially as Reformed Christians, we have something that's utterly unique. The world can't get what we offer anywhere else. And so that's why we don't want to change and adapt the message, and even in some respects, the methodology, for the sake of the culture, because then they can get it somewhere else. Why would they want to come here? It baffles the mind still that people go to mega churches where it's fluff. You can get that in 1,000 other places. I can think of 1,000 better reasons to spend on my Sunday morning than go to, you know, what's basically a glorified Amway convention. You know, that's really kind of what it is at times. We have a large mega church right down the street from my house. We drive past it every Sunday. And, you know, it's a constant change in the gigantic sign they put out on the highway and on the roads with all the things under the sun to get people to show up. You guys have churches that do door prizes yet around you? Door prizes? No, you haven't had that yet? We have churches that give out door prizes now by us. You know, you come on Easter, come on Christmas or whatever, and it's basically a raffle. And passing out prizes, and you know, you can win cash, you can win iPads. I have a friend that was a mega church youth pastor right down the road from us. He ended up resigning and going into seminary, and in Reformed Seminary. And after he left, he was a youth pastor. The youth group began to dwindle, and so the leadership of that church that existed thought, well, here's how we're going to get it back up to, you know, up to ground zero, and then we're going to build it up again. They bought 100 iPods to pass out to new kids who came to the youth group. So they'd tell the kids, they'd rally them up on Sunday morning and tell your friends, if you come, you get a free iPod. First 100, first come, first serve. So we come with something totally different, totally night and day to that. So context is good news. You actually have something to say. Something different, something unique, something that actually is helpful, that actually is lasting, that's not going to change. Shane Lem says this, speaking of context, culture, why it's good news. He says this: rather than hunker down in traditional trenches and long for a return to the golden age of modernity, the church plant should stand on the tallest building in town and herald the sounds of the gospel that will shake the world and bring some home. That's what we do. We stand as watchmen. We stand as warner, as those who warn and who preach the gospel to the world around us. So, just in conclusion, just to kind of sum it up, know the area in which you would like to plant, and know the man that you would like to send. Know the area. Yes, there are sinners there, but what in particular about that area can you use your advantage and can you adapt into to be able to bring the gospel, and know the man, know the qualities and the characteristics, find someone that can fit into that context. And I find it sort of perplexing a lot of times. We think about foreign missions a lot in terms of raising up indigenous leadership, don't we? Why would you send me, Danny Hyde, a white guy from the beach, to Africa to be a pastor? It makes no sense. Send a guy like me to go train pastors so that they can pastor their own people. And so that's a good methodology. But a lot of times we don't think in those terms in terms of home missions. A lot of times it's necessity. It's like we have a group of people that want a church. We got one guy who's available, and we throw him out there. We want to go plant a church somewhere, and it's hard to find people leaving, you know, a certain position in a pulpit to go plant a church. And a lot of times it comes down to, like, you know, like the luck of the draw, to use the term, to send someone. And a lot of times it doesn't work out so well. We found in our classes, we've had a lot of success in church planting. I think 10 of our 13, 14 churches are church plants in our classes in the last decade plus. But we've also had not as many, but nearly as many failures in our classes. And a lot of times it comes down to this. It's the wrong guy in the wrong place at the wrong time, right? So think about it in terms of, you know, we think about foreign missions, indigenous leadership. Think about it in terms of home missions. Who do we know? Who do we find that's from, you know, a similar sort of background, or a person that is adaptable, who's willing to go somewhere and to become part of that place. We wouldn't send some city slicker to go into Northwest Iowa, dressing like, you know, he just came from the beach. At least I don't think, you know, I wouldn't do that. And you wouldn't send, you know, some country boy who, you know, has a straw in his mouth with a corncob hat to Los Angeles if he's not going to change, right? It's necessary. So know the man, the kind of man, how he can adapt, how he can fit into a particular context. One last way in which I think that we can do this is even in our small churches, raising up young men that can then at some point return back from, say, seminary, or say they take a call somewhere else, but eventually can come back to where they're from and plant a church somewhere near where they grew up or where the original church was that sent them out in the first place. So not just being, you know, a sending church to seminary and, you know, having a great list of guys that have gone out to plant churches, but those guys coming back and eventually planting something nearby. And I think it's a helpful thing to think in those terms of long-term strategy. You know, who can we raise up in our own midst and then daughter a church, plant a church somewhere in the near vicinity, because he's already sort of one of us, as it were.